Hello there and welcome to a Culturefile digital single where we stretch our legs a bit with some extra sounds. Our next Culturefile debate spends some time in the garden, wondering why it is that gardens and gardening have become intriguing, rich and resonant for artists. That session, which is happening on Thursday, 25th of September at the Mermaid in Bray, takes place in the context of an exhibition currently at the Mermaid's Gallery, Composting Colonialism Towards the Radical Garden. It brings together some artists who've been thinking about gardens and growing, as well as some of those involved in Dirt Under the Nails projects, such as Bray's community-based Mermaid Garden Project. Culturefile's Niamh Daly went to the show and met some of those taking part, including curators Alida Maiquez and Anne-Marie.
What does it mean to decolonize a garden is the question we're still asking through the exhibition. I think if we were to decolonize any garden, it would be incredibly different from how we think it ought to look or how it looks now. My name is Anne-Marie. I'm a visual art curator and creative producer, and I mostly work with artists to devise new work for exhibitions, and I currently work as the curator at Mermaid Art Centre in Bray in County Wicklow. This exhibition is called Composting Colonialism Towards the Radical Garden, and it arose, as most of the things that I work on do, through lots of coincidences, conversations, and sort of seeing similar themes being addressed through artists, writers, and so on. I had been aware of Alida, in my case, my co-curator, who works through horticulture as part of her practice. It's a really central part of her practice. She's a guerrilla gardener. She grows willow to work with and make structures with. She makes comics which address issues around climate change. And I had also encountered the work of many of the artists in the exhibition in different shows or through studio visits. And I could see a sort of theme arising around the issue of colonialism, which in this country we are hyper aware of and yet often don't really address head on for our own complex reasons. One of the interesting aspects of thinking about the role of the garden in colonialism was through how many informal gardens that we can go and visit on a Sunday here are actually belonging to former big houses. So they in themselves represent an aspect of that part of our history. And they also contain plants that come from all over the world that were often stolen, trafficked, if that's not too an extreme a word to use around plants. But they mirror the colonial experience in lots of ways. And also through Alida's work with the Mermaid Garden Project, which is a project for local community gardeners that she's originated here at Mermaid Arts Centre, I knew that there were people who were struggling to find places to become gardeners. They couldn't grow their own food because they didn't have a garden, they lived in an apartment, or they might have a window box and a thriving balcony, but they kind of wanted more and they wanted to also engage with other gardeners and share information and experiences. So all of those things kind of convened, really. I was interested in how gardens represent status in a lot of ways. And I even think that having a kind of smart, close-cropped, very green lawn represents that kind of thinking about adhering to a social norm. And people achieve that by going to a garden centre and buying lawn feed and lawn mowers and pruning shears and strimmers and all the rest of it. And, you know, every Saturday and Sunday all around the country, you can hear the hum of these machines keeping these gardens in check and forming them to look a certain way. And I've been really struck by, and through looking into garden history, how the origin of that perception of what a garden is very much moulded by wealth and power and privilege. So even the trend towards rewilding harks back to Capability Brown's creation of wild, in inverted commas, landscapes that became really fashionable in the 18th century, when he would construct a sort of fake wilderness. But it was all very carefully managed so that it would represent an area of wetland, a lake, which was inevitably dug by labourers and wasn't there in the first place, a large parkland, which allowed a beautiful vista from the house of the very wealthy person so that they could sit there enjoying their sherry or whatever on their terrace and see beautiful trees and lawns and wild places that weren't really part of the original landscape but gave the impression of being something that was. And on the smaller scale, domestically, we try and recreate a lot of that. The bigger picture comes from trends in wealth, power and privilege to the kind of aesthetics that we apply to gardening. Today, I don't think that's changed very much. If you look at gardening programs where garden designers come in and apply a vision, it will often include aspects of things that are seen as being unusual. So there's a kind of a exoticism of the rare and the unusual, or mimicking wild places, or introducing specific types of plants for their colour and shape and form, or thinking about things from a point of view which might be seen as slightly elitist, so that the garden is very architectural and needs a huge amount of maintenance to stay that way. And all of these things, I think, kind of contribute to the garden representing this microcosm of societal desire for display of status. Today, there's a real judgment applied to things that are not seen as being natural. Whereas when researching this show, I came across accounts of things like proto-gardening in the Amazonian jungle. So an environment that we would think of as being wild. In fact, the indigenous people that have lived there for hundreds and hundreds of years would engage in kinds of gardening, whether it's clearing a space beneath a tree that provided a particular fruit that was part of their diet, or encouraging something to grow on, you know, a hillside across from the normal hillside it would grow on. The human hand has always been very evident in growing and in the way that we manage the land. So I think the idea of a kind of natural garden, those natural spaces don't really exist. Even when you look at the ancient landscape of Ireland, it's covered in ring forts and earthworks and standing stones and things that, you know, the tourist board will tell you are part of the natural environment, and they're not. They're part of really, really hard work that a whole community has undertaken to create a kind of a landscape that reflected things that they were important to them. So I think all of those ideas are really interesting to interrogate through the lens of gardening and gardening on the domestic scale. For Alida and I, in thinking about this exhibition, a really key thing was to think about how do we coexist with the results of the colonized garden? How do we work with what's available, and how do we as gardeners, growers, or if you're not a gardener grower and you'd like to be a gardener grower, begin to engage with that as a kind of everyday practice that's part of your life. Maybe thinking about what we buy at the garden centre, maybe looking for heritage varieties of things to diversify what's grown so that we don't have monocultures within a food type or food crop. So maybe it's to think about all of those things that contribute to a really rich tapestry of what a garden can be. One of the artists in the exhibition is Grace Enomaku, who is an Irish-Nigerian artist and illustrator based here in Dublin. And this was a commission, an original commission from Grace to create a world map. Grace was really interested in the triangular trade. The triangular trade is the term that's used for the way that crops were exported, that people were stolen and taken to other places, and where they were taken back to. So as an example, goods like cloth and machinery would be taken from the UK and Northern Europe to Western Africa, where they would be offloaded and sold. People, who were generally stolen from their homeland, were then taken on the same ships to what was then termed the New World, so to the Americas, to the Caribbean, to North South America, to the countries where colonizers, including the British, Portuguese, French, and Dutch, had established huge agricultural farms, which are generally known as plantations. There they would grow foodstuffs that were also sourced from different parts of the world. So, for example, sugar, which was incredibly popular from the 1600s onwards and originally comes from Papua New Guinea. So from Papua New Guinea, it was taken to all these different countries and established as a huge food crop. There are others, including rubber, tea, coffee and tobacco. Then when they were ready to be harvested and shipped, they were loaded back onto the same ships that had taken the enslaved people there to grow them, back to the countries that began the apex of the triangle in the first place. So that trade kind of plotted those routes, so they were always, you know, working for their living by being full of trade goods or people or the crops that arose from that trade. We often think of the world as being relatively recently mobile, and actually enormous distances were being covered and enormous journeys were being made, which of course are really, really interesting, but they do kind of illustrate, I suppose, the extent of human ambition and greed.
So let's go have a look at the exhibition.
Do we start at the beginning, or do you want to start at the end?
Let's start at the beginning.
Would you like to turn this down?
Where is it coming from?
From the tree.
So what are we listening to?
We're listening to an original composition by Tara Bauf Mooney and Dermot McDermott.
Veins of trade, dirt for blood, collect, control, coerce, corrupt. Veins of trade, dirt for blood.
It was commissioned by Porrick Cunningham as part of his piece A Long Way, which is comprised of most of the bark from a beautiful Monterey cypress tree.
And it's quite long. How many feet is it?
16 feet.
And it's got this gorgeous moth still living on it.
And there's a space blanket draped over it, the kind that you see marathon runners wearing when they've finished.
So it's this sort of like metallic.
Very shiny. In California, they use them to protect the trees during forest fires. So the trees all get a little jacket when there's forest fires threatened to help protect them from that. This is Harald Offe being a hermit in his grotto, Arcadia Reimagined, which is a reimagining again of an earlier work from an exhibition at Ham House in London. He was actually in the garden as the living hermit in the grotto.
Yeah, it looks like big blocks of stone in an archway and then a little kind of cubby hole where he's sort of standing and
looking contemplative and spiritual.
I think we're rolling. I'm Harald Offe. My work is often exploring, I think, histories, particular historical context, thinking about archives, thinking about how particularly identity and representation is often kind of formed through popular culture, but also things like the archive as a kind of collective memory. In relation to this exhibition at the Mermaid, I'm showing a piece called Arcadia Redesigned, which was originally a commission about 12 years ago that I did with the National Trust in England, and specifically in response to a historical house called Ham House, which is on the River Thames in Richmond, and responding to the history of this garden, a 16th century garden, of this Dysart family who sort of rose during the English Civil Wars. And this house is built out of that kind of period and in response to this family really that are on the rise. And what often I'm trying to do with a lot of projects is trying to make like contemporary links to outmoded like histories or kind of histories that seem very detached from where we are in the present. And it just seemed really interesting to me that this family were just very clearly, you know, on the rise. Nouveau riche, parvenus, you know, using all these terms. But like, you know, they were on the make, you know, they took an opportunity, and the house is, you know, even by the standards of the day, was like gauche. I was kind of like, people were talking about how the, you know, the family very much projecting their wealth with these features and using the garden and the house as a way of kind of eliciting sort of power. And for me, the sort of contemporary equivalent of that is, you know, we might think about tech billionaires or like footballers or like, you know, often people that are culturally derided but have made money quickly and are wanting to establish power and influence. In researching the garden, I was interested in how in the 16th and 17th century, there were the beginnings of this tendency for rich people to use their gardens as a kind of playground for exploring fantasies. You know, you see it at its highest point in the 18th century with like Marie Antoinette playing shepherdess and things like that. But there are origins going back into the kind of 16th and 17th century where it's a playground for the rich and they make boating lakes and do mock ship battles. And one particular thing which relates to the project that I'm showing was this history of hermits. I was sort of reading an account where they'd employed this former Civil War veteran, I guess, to be a resident hermit. And the homeowners are wanting to kind of leverage culture and historical references. So they're making allusions to classical paintings. You know, you'd see like this kind of Arcadian ideal landscape, and in it you would have a wise sage, a hermit, as a kind of an expression of classical knowledge, you know. So they wanted to replicate that within their new landowning spaces and their gardens. And then the idea is that you could, when your guests came round, you could show them round, you know, your different landscaped features, the water feature, the grotto. And then there'd be like a kind of hermit, which is basically like a living gnome, you know. And sort of across the 17th century and the 18th century, this became more and more popular. And they'd build these, it's kind of like huts, and then they'd employ these people to kind of, you know, be hermits. So it's kind of leveraging culture for power, really. You could argue from one sense in the early instances that they're giving people kind of employment, there's a degree of security, people are kind of, are attached to the land. But for me, there's a kind of interesting thing in the sort of double standard in that obviously a lot of these landowners have like tenants, you know, who are not performing poor. They're just like really poor, obviously. So those people are kind of hidden away. You don't show your visitors, your tenants. You know, the past has kind of like flattened out, you know, the kind of taste factor. I was reading sort of accounts of, so how were this family received by other people? You know, they were putting on all these spectacles and people thought it was just like really tacky, like tryhards. But that's lost when people go around the gardens. Oh, it's beautiful. Oh, look at these classical, you know. And for me, it's like the equivalence in like 300 years of going around footballers' homes and having a cup of tea in their garden, thinking, oh, these people were very sophisticated. This, or, you know, look at the gold toilet, you know, things like that. Isn't that wonderful? So for me, it was important to make that kind of link that actually, you know, history has kind of shifted. And let's think about them in their own time and leveraging culture for power. What's in the show at the Mermaid is an image, is a large cutout of me playing this role of a kind of hermit in a sort of theatrical grotto cave. So I had this cave theatre prop commissioned, and that was placed in the gardens at Ham House. And then I would perform as the kind of live-in sort of hermit, and people could come and talk to me and, you know. But for me, that strategy was about trying to bring the ridiculousness and to bring the kind of, I mean, it's absurd comic, but also I think to sort of maybe speak to some of the dynamics of the time that I think are often lost with, the kind of leisure heritage culture of, you know, wasn't it wonderful in the past? Oh, wasn't it great that, you know, oh, look at this beautiful, you know, and I'm not sort of trying to negate that. There's nothing wrong, I think, per se, with like enjoying being in a space. But for me, I think it's important to really, really bring in some of the more complexity and to provide a way of people dealing with complexity. Yeah, you can have a cup of tea and enjoy the flowers. I enjoy that myself. But also, I think let's recognize the kind of history of these structures. Let's recognize, you know, the power dynamics and the legacies of how these buildings have come about and the motivations of the people who have contributed to kind of building them. And that for me is really, really important, particularly I think in the context of the UK and Ireland, where, you know, we're kind of littered with these like colonial relics. And I think particularly for me of concern in the UK is that those histories are really suppressed and people aren't aware of, you know, how these great houses have come to be built and how they connect us to these global histories. And, you know, it's not about raining on people's parade, but I think it's important for us to understand contemporary politics and the contemporary situation. And to do that, we have to understand the historical legacy.
My name is Elida Maikes. I am a Wicklow-based artist with roots in Guatemala and Spain. I work in the triangle where wildlife, art making, and community meet. I've been a seed librarian for 2 years, so working with seeds very systematically, creating a collection, planting them, testing them, distributing them, cataloging them. That is also part of my art practice. I tend to grow edibles, medicinals, wild plants, and trees and bushes.
So what are some examples of the plants that you have?
Yarrow, knapweed, marsh marigold, things like flax, linseed, all crops, all Irish crops, with seeds from Irish seed savers. They are also open pollinated. That is for me important. Open pollinated seeds are, if you hold a seed that is open pollinated in your hand, somehow it has been put in your hand by your grandmother or someone's grandmother, and that the grandparents have kept those seeds, and that, you know, takes you 50 grandmothers away, perhaps, and that has made those varieties stable so that you are guaranteed that it will grow a very similar plant. As a child, I've always admired something that was close to me, and that was that person who could identify bird song, that person who could look at a tree and identify it. I didn't know how that was done. I didn't think it was impossible the way I lived. I was living in a town that was kind of becoming suburbia or becoming city. So all the orchards were gone. I still swam in that river. I still, you know, trampled those fields and played with my brothers there. But I was probably, you know, the last generation to do that. So because now it's built up. So say like 10 years ago, I used drawing as my entry point to know plants. So I would pick up a wild flower that I wanted to know what it was, and I would just draw it. Edible Break has been going on for like, I think, I don't know, 12 years maybe. It's a community garden group that is planting edible gardens, a trail of edible gardens that everybody can grow and everybody can harvest. And there's like 7 sites, I think, across Bray. There's, for instance, a group in Connolly Square working with the neighbors, growing things like pumpkins and onions. So each group is different. So on Thursdays, we meet in the Mermaid Garden Project, which is just outside the cafe in Mermaid. And now we are coordinating with Criok Cafe. because they would love to use the herbs that we're growing. So there's a really circular connection.
So what's on the agenda for today, the gardening agenda?
It's the weekly feed for the plants. They get fed usually liquid seaweed once a week, just to check them over.
We have a little Mediterranean corner here with a rescued olive tree, some mint. This one is another rosemary, and more thyme, and this is dill, perhaps? Dill?
Yes,
John?
That's
dill. That's rosemary as well.
Oh, wow.
A different variety.
Oh, it's lovely.
The plants we grow ourselves mainly. We grow them from seed. They're organically produced. We feed them organically. Our volunteers come here once a week and make sure everything is watered and fed and the weeds are kept in order and that sort of thing. Well, I'm John. I'm one of the volunteers in Edible Bray. We have 46 members at the moment in Edible Bray.
And what is it that you like about coming?
You meet people who are interested in growing edibles and you learn an awful lot from them.
And then there's that thing of other gardeners bring their own style and their own interest. John holds that kind of edible, the vegetable potatoes are kind of a speciality this year, every year, I must say. And I also kind of use a lot of medicinal or plant a lot of medicinal and edibles, like multiple uses. So if it serves humans and pollinators both, that's my, you know, that's the area that I love. But it's all complementary and it changes according to whoever is present.
Very much so. And because we work in here with Tag and the management of the cafe at the Mermaid, what they would like us to grow here are herbs, because they can use them in the kitchen.
You said that you've learned a lot from doing the gardening. What have you learned from the gardening?
A different way of planting potatoes for springs to mind. I'm originally from Northern Ireland, and the way people up there plant potatoes is different from the way people in Wicklow plant potatoes, and it's different from the way people in Britain plant potatoes. So it's interesting to see a whole different sort of subculture of how to grow potatoes.
And what is it? What do we do here?
Well, here they're laid out in drills, so you do like a sort of trench and drill system. And in Northern Ireland, typically, we just punch holes in the soil and put the potato tuber in and cover it over, and then earth up as they grow. But by making the trench and drills, you have them pre-earthed up, as it were. So it saves you labour later on in the process. But it means all the labour is done up front. That's the last one.
I think we're there for friendship and then for gardening. But like it's difficult to separate it because you're tending to the land, even if it's just a pot, together with someone, that is in itself, even if you don't harvest anything, you've already done your work.
In the exhibition description, one of the questions is, what does it mean to decolonize a garden? So what are your thoughts on it?
The notion that the species which actually grow there, have been growing there for millennia, are a nuisance, are part of a colonized mind. I walk and I see a lot of gardens as I walk, and some of them, I understand the need for order, and I have that sometimes on my desk, on my living room, in the kitchen, and I know that need is an actual need, but also sometimes it's a need for my own internal order.
What are your thoughts on the word weed?
On the word weed?
Yeah, what are your thoughts on this idea of a weed?
I think the word weed as a nuisance comes from our relationship with the land. So if we want to control what happens in our garden completely, there's going to be 100 individuals that are going to be a nuisance or a pest or a weed. So I feel that we would be kind of happier if we gave up that need for control. I feel if we paid attention to those beings that are there, very close attention, the attention of a toddler, we would fall in love with them.
Voices from the garden there and composting colonialism towards the radical garden continues at the Mermaid in Bray, where the Culture File debate will be recorded live next Thursday, 25th of September. See Culture File on Insta or Blue Sky for details, or find your way to the mermaidsartcentre.ie, where there's a link for booking.